All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back to Taxation is Theft, the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off and what you can do to stop them. Broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico, I'm Dan Taxation is Theft Berman, former candidate for President of the United States, currently in the race for Governor of Texas. And today I have an amazing guest, Christine Olivo. And a few of Christine's tweets caught my eye and I completely agreed with her. And then I found out she was running for the Florida House as a Democrat. Oh no. But I'm going to talk to her today and see if we can agree on some common ground and find some more liberty-oriented solutions to the problems she's attempting to solve. Of course, before we get started, if you're watching the live stream, please remember to like and share and comment and ask questions and send your remarks. I can already see somebody's commenting, communism will win. We're not going there. Tonight's episode is brought to you by the Nug of Knowledge, indoor-grown, chemical-free, smokable hemp, flower, and Delta 8 vape cartridges, legal in all 50 states. Get elevated at nugofknowledge.com. And now on to the show. Christine, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I am really excited for our conversation.
Awesome. So I guess let's start out with this. What got you into politics?
Ooh, good question. My children got me into politics, knowing that we were going to leave this world behind to the next generation sort of changed my view and just my participation in government, in politics. I couldn't just be a bystander anymore. I had to jump in and make an effort to give my children a better life.
So really great point about, you know, I think everybody wants to leave a better place for their kids. Was there a moment you say you couldn't just stand by anymore? Was there something that happened where you realized, hey, this world might not be fit for to leave my kids in? I have to fix something here.
Yes. It was the moment that I saw families being separated from their children at the borders. Both of my grandmothers came here from Haiti. And I know, especially my maternal grandmother, she was pregnant. She was fleeing an abusive husband. She had to literally, you know, change her name and come here. And she, because of her, we're all here. She built a phenomenal life. She has contributed so much to the United States. And so just as a child of an immigrant and my father also came from Haiti. So as a child of an immigrant, and also as a mother, that for me was just like the breaking point.
Right. And I remember seeing all this stuff. I know a lot of people. I'm gonna try to figure out how to phrase this throughout the conversation, because I know there's you're pretty much coming from a Democrat philosophy, right? You're running with the Democrat Party. Is that?
So I ran as a non-party affiliate my first election.
My apologies. I totally screwed that up then.
No, it's fine. And what I realized in this district is that it doesn't matter. I'm not saying that it doesn't matter about policies, but people vote based on their party. They vote based off of name recognition. I mean, I can have the best platform ever. It doesn't matter. Our district is just not that informed. And that's on us, right? Those that are fighting to get to that place. If you're running for Congress, if you're running for mayor, it's on us to educate the people. It's harder to do when you don't have those kind of funds. So I had such an issue trying to educate people and tell people, listen, neither side cares about you. But at the end of the day, I realized that for me, the goal is to get in. and I have to sort of stop trying to go against the grain and sort of try to see where I can fit in.
Okay. That actually makes a lot of sense. So, and the reason I thought Democrat was because some of your policy positions are Democrat.
Yes. And I'm running as a Democrat. So, you
okay.
know.
But so, yeah. okay, but you're kind of like, you're coming from an independent background running as a Democrat.
Yes.
Okay. So, so I guess the point I wanted to straighten out was, let's say your camp, which is, let's just say Democrats for the sake mm-hmm. of simplicity, and my camp, which is Libertarians for the sake of simplicity, because they know, they've heard me say it plenty of times. I'm half in, half out with them half the time. So. But you're absolutely right in that, I see Libertarians talking all the time about running with the Republican Party because the Libertarian Party doesn't have the money, they don't have the resources, they don't have the name recognition. We had a presidential candidate who got 1 million votes for the last 3 presidential cycles, and most of the people I talk to still have no idea who they are. So yeah, I totally get that. Okay, so going back to this issue of the border and the kids being separated from families, I think my camp and your camp both really sympathized with that. We really saw the injustice. And so I think that's definitely amazing. That kind of comes from that like compassionate, nurturing type of, you know, caring about other people. That makes us want to fix that problem. I think that's a really great glue for people to have between each other, like, you know, to understand that, like, we want to take care of each other.
Yes, it's a great place to start. We're starting from a place of love and compassion. Obviously, there will be differences in policy, but at least we know that at the core, we all want the same thing. We want people to be treated like human beings, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting. Like, so you say you want, like, people just want to be treated like human beings. And it's interesting because when I see a lot of people argue over politics, it almost comes down to, okay, what does that mean to treat everyone like human beings? It means respect all of their rights. And then there's this argument over, well, X, Y, Z is a right, but A, B, and C is not. And so there's almost this fight over, you know, yeah, I totally agree. Everybody should have their rights respected, but they don't agree on what rights are. So what do you think rights are, and where do you think rights come from?
I think rights are things that are given to you just for being alive. You have the right to live. You have the right to fight for your life as far as healthcare is concerned. You have the right to work. You're part of this society. You have the right to contribute to your community. I just believe that rights come from you being born, being alive, God-given rights. You know, I do think that I understand that it can go both ways. Say, well, then I have the right to do bad things too. I feel that we all have a right to do things that allow us to coexist, to thrive, to move forward. I believe that rights are, they're not earned. I believe that you have a right to housing in America. You have a right to healthcare. You have a right to defend yourself. These are things, especially being in America, a lot of our rights are in the Constitution, but they didn't just come from the Constitution. That's not where they were born. They were born from creation.
Right. And that's really interesting how you described that. And I actually did a live stream this morning about the 9th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, because everyone thinks like, oh, your rights. I mean, yes, a lot of people think the rights come from the Constitution, which I think we agree they don't. But what's interesting is, like, a lot of people say, oh, this is a right. And then they're like, well, where does it say that in the Constitution? And almost nobody, if I were to ask you about the 9th Amendment, do you know what it is? It's okay if you don't.
Well, say it. Maybe I do. Okay. I just don't know that it's the 9th.
Well, here, let me pull it up and actually read it. It's probably going to take me more time. Let me paraphrase it from memory. Even though the Bill of Rights has enumerated certain rights, it does not mean that there are not other rights that you have, which are your rights. So basically, it's saying just because we didn't list it out doesn't mean you don't have that right.
Awesome.
So it's kind of the 10th Amendment is, I think more people know about the 10th Amendment. It's kind of the same, but not, but with a different twist to it, where it says any power not given to the federal government is reserved for the state government or the people. Okay, so you know that one. So what's interesting is, and this is what I was talking about this morning, is so there are rights which are not listed in the Constitution, but the document leading up to the Constitution said all men are created equal and they have unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So you know, I think that goes in line with a lot of the rights that you described, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Those are constitutionally protected rights that the government should not infringe on. Agree?
I agree.
Okay, awesome. So So you brought up healthcare and housing, and I want to get into those because I think that's where we agree. Okay, my camp probably disagrees with you on the solution, on the solution as well, but on the problem. I actually agree with you on the problem, but I have a difference of opinion on the solution. So we'll get into that in a minute. But you did bring up the right to defend yourself. What's your position on the right to defend yourself?
If we're talking gun laws, I do believe that everybody has the right to defend themselves, bear arms, but I do think that we also need certain restrictions. I have a concealed weapons license. I carry when I feel like I need to, but I also don't think that there's anything wrong with saying that we need strict background checks, universal background checks, that we have to wait before we can purchase a firearm until that background check comes back. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that we need a national database so that we can, you know, see what firearm is registered to which person. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that we need mental health checks to make sure that people are mentally capable. Owning a firearm, you literally can take somebody's life. It's a huge responsibility. So it's not saying that you can't, it's just saying that there needs to be restrictions and there things need to be met in order for that. And I think that certain firearms are, we're not in war. I'm sorry, there's one thing about defending yourself, there's another thing for carrying firearms that are going to cause an all-out war. So those are the different things that, and honestly, I do believe, because my husband is a huge gun supporter. So it's like I understand it. I'm not as excited about, you know, the Second Amendment as he is. I do it. I like I said, I participate. I got my license. I went to the class. I have a firearm. Out of respect for my life and my children, and living in Miami, a six-year-old just got shot on Saturday, shot and killed at a kid's party. So I understand the need. I understand it all too well. It's personal. But then we also have to see who had that firearm that then killed this innocent little girl. It's so complex. I do believe that there needs to be a compromise so that it's not just everyone thinking, oh, they're going to take our guns away. They're going to take our rights away. Absolutely not. But, you know, nobody's trying to take anyone's car away, but you still have to get a license. My husband's a truck driver. He had to get a special license to drive an 18-wheeler. So, you know, you need a special license maybe for a semi-automatic or, you know, like, let's talk about restrictions and regulations. Let's not talk about taking anything away. Let's just talk about making sure that people are safe and they get home, period. We need to get home.
Right. And I, you know, I see a lot of these stories all the time. There was one actually just a couple of weeks ago in San Antonio where there was a kid who he was playing around. He pointed the gun at the other kid's head, pulled the trigger, and killed him. And there's definitely a lot of these tragedies that I see and I can sympathize with. My concern is, you know, just like what happened at the border, right? The only reason that there was a camp set up where they could separate kids from their family was because they innocently said, well, we're going to allow people in the country. We just need to make sure we do background checks. And that's kind of like how they started. That's kind of how they got their foot in the door. And then, of course, it escalated. And over time, they now have. Exactly. So I think that's generally the concern that you know, most gun owners have. And it's, you know, not necessarily because I don't think a single person is going to look at that and say, oh, my God, a kid killed another kid. You know, nobody's going to say, yeah, Second Amendment. Like no one's going to get excited and happy about that. And I think, you know, maybe they don't have an answer to that. There's a lot of people who say, yeah, well, we need better training, which might be true. But I think, you know, that is a very valid concern. And as much as you might not want to take people's guns away completely, there definitely are people out there who are kind of pushing for that in their agenda. And a lot of them won't openly say it, but you know, if you pry enough there, that's there. So,
so then what about creating a policy where we address that, saying not now or down the line, can you use this information or use this database or use all of this to then, you know, strip away everybody's guns, you know, just right. Putting something to protect that so that people can feel comfortable.
Have you seen the show Walking Dead?
I love it.
Okay. So this is a perfect example. You remember, I'm trying to think of the name of the town that they had where they spent like five seasons, where it was like they had the solar and everything, and it was very enclosed. They had the walls and everything around it, and they decided, hey, everything is so peaceful here, what we're gonna do is we're gonna take all of our guns and we're gonna check them into the armory. Nobody's gonna need
to. Okay. I do remember that.
Then what happened was Negan came around and he was like, oh, interesting, we have a book here. Oh, and there's a gun missing. And he used that to basically confiscate every single gun in that village, and then to even know, hey, there's one missing, who has it? And then he was able to find out, you know, who had it and get it back, leaving them completely disarmed. So
that is very extreme. That's what I said. You have to put laws in place so that wouldn't happen. That is very extreme. And I understand that America has done a lot of extreme things in its past. I don't see that flying today.
Well, and you might be right, but my interest is not so much in the government doing something, because at that point, you know, was it Alexandria? Was that the city?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Alexandria.
At that point, it wasn't the government of Alexandria that said, we're going to confiscate all the guns, because, I mean,
it was Negan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
he had access to it. He was able to access these documents and use it. So you're saying that some other forces may come in and infiltrate.
And we've already seen data leaks. We've already seen, like, you know, there was a state that had like a registration of everybody who had a concealed gun license, and somebody printed that list and put it up online so that they could go door to door and harass people who were gun owners. So I think there are some very valid concerns that, like, because like there's a law in place that says that information is supposed to be private. It's not supposed to be given out. And yet somehow it still got leaked. And I think that's a very major concern. So but that's good to see that, you know, I think you're at least a little bit in line with us in self-defense. So I want to get to probably hopefully a less touchy subject, healthcare and housing. Which one do you want to go with first?
Let's do healthcare. Let's just rip off the Band-Aid.
Okay, awesome. So healthcare. The main motivation for this is it's not more taxes. It's not more government. It's not more control. It's for more people to have healthcare, right? Is that?
I think it's for more people to have the exact same quality healthcare.
So for everybody to have,
like it doesn't matter if I make 10,000 a year or if I make 1 million a year, we should be able to go in and have the same exact healthcare.
Okay. I want to disagree with that, but to stay more on point, I think we both agree that
everybody should have healthcare.
Everybody should have better healthcare than they have now at the very least. Right? Okay. So, one of the things that that I like to look at are, and you're a supporter of the the Medicare for All?
Yes.
Okay. My objection to Medicare for All, let's start there. Because I think everybody kind of knows what that is. Unless
I'm
you have
taking
a special
notes.
Twist. Okay. So my thing is this. Mm-hmm. What Medicare for All attempts to solve is healthcare has a very high cost, right? Anybody can access, mm-hmm. everybody has access to the best healthcare in the world as long as they have the money. But the money is the hard part because it's extremely expensive right now. Mm-hmm. So right now we have this conversation, and a lot of what I see from the Democrats is if they're trying to find a way to pay that extremely high cost of healthcare so that everybody can basically afford it. And that's what I see as Medicare is kind of like an insurance program that, you know, you go to the hospital, they give you a bill for $1 million, and Medicare is going to be like, oh, that's okay, we'll pay for that.
Yeah.
What my concern is that in doing so, the cost of that care is not actually $1 million. It's basically a bunch of corporations that have created these monopoly protections.
Prices.
Yeah. And then, yeah, exactly. They're manipulating the prices. They're making them that high. And when we try to come up with a government program to pay those high prices, what we're basically doing is we're caving to their extortion racket. So we're basically saying, yeah, okay, you guys want to rip us off? Fine. We'll just create a government program, and they'll either steal from somebody or they'll print the money in order to pay your extremely high prices. You're still going to get paid your extremely high prices, but at least I'm going to get my healthcare. Instead of saying, well, let's fix the problem that makes that healthcare so expensive, because I don't think there's a person in the world who can't afford Tylenol, but there are a lot of people in the United States who can't afford insulin, and they absolutely need it. So if we can solve that problem and make it to where healthcare is absolutely affordable, where it's so inexpensive that it doesn't really become an issue of can I afford the best quality care. It's just nobody thinks about the price. They just walk in there, oh yeah, whatever the price is, that's fine, because I know it's not going to be that high. That's kind of where I see the first goal should be. And yes, we can have insurance and things on top of it to help pay for, you know, unexpected costs that are higher. Obviously, you know, if you get cancer, that's going to be more expensive than if you need your monthly supply of insulin. But if we can bring the cost of everything down and then kind of reevaluate, that would be much better than trying to figure out how do we just pay, you know, pay the bribe, pay the extortion, pay the kidnappers the ransom that they want. What do you think about that?
I think that the issue, number one, is that it still leaves the haves and the have nots separated by who has the money to afford it. And so you're proposing that the government puts a mandate on prices, like we now control the prices for not just for services, but also for medicine. At the end of the day, I still don't think that anyone should be profiting off of saving somebody's life. I think that everything should be at cost. Obviously, people get paid for doing their service or whatever the case is, but people are making bank, profiting off of this. So I do agree that the government doesn't need to pay their prices. I think that we should lower the prices and still pay for it, because we pay taxes, and I know you think taxation is theft. So we pay taxes for things that benefit our community. We pay taxes for programs or for positions. So like We pay taxes for the president or for, you know, our members of Congress. We pay taxes for programs like Medicare or, you know, different programs that we have. We pay taxes for things that benefit us, right? If we're already paying taxes for all these different things, and then on top of that, we're paying for insurance costs, why not shift the cost to our taxes? So things are still getting paid, but we're taking that extra burden off of paying these insurances that are making so much money off of us. We need to get rid of the for-profit insurances. We need to get rid of big pharma, but we also, I do believe in Medicare for all. I do not think that someone that makes more money than me deserves to have access to something that could save my life just because I can't afford it.
Right. And well, okay. So let me correct one thing. When you talk about lowering the prices, I'm not talking about forcing them to lower prices. What I'm talking about is removing. So all of these, you know, that you talk about big pharma, and you know, this structure of monopolies and everything that they have, this isn't just a bunch of greedy corporations that decided we're going to make our price really high. I mean, it is that at its core, that's what it is. But yes, in order for them to do that, what they've done is they've used the government to make that happen. So, for example,
yeah, they lobby.
Right. But it's the programs they put in place. So, for example, it's illegal to bring insulin from Mexico into the United States. And because of that, the same manufacturer that sells their insulin in the United States for $100 is selling that same insulin in Mexico for $12. And that's because Mexico has a more open policy where their version of the FDA approves more companies to export their insulin into Mexico. And because of that, they have to compete and they have to lower their prices. In the United States, we actually have the FDA, which is, you know, there to protect us. And what they're doing is they're saying, you know, through the lobbying, they're saying, oh yeah, we're only going to approve. There's only three companies allowed to sell insulin. There's 47 in the whole world, but there's only three companies allowed to sell insulin in the United States, because of the FDA. And if you remove those restrictions, there are doctors here from the Philippines, from India, from Africa, everywhere. There are doctors and nurses here who are completely capable of doing their job. They would pass all the qualifications, but we have the AMA and these boards that literally prevent more than X number of doctors and nurses from practicing. So while it sounds great that the government cares about us, the reality is what they're doing shows that they actually care more about propping up the corporations. And I want to talk one more point. And I totally lost it.
Think about it.
So let's see, you were talking about, how am I going to phrase it? Okay. You were talking about taxes. Let's talk about taxes for a second.
Mm-hmm.
So ideally that sounds great, right? We're all paying taxes into this big system. They have all this money now. Why shouldn't they use that money for our benefit? And I completely agree. If we're going to pay into a system, why would we pay into that system if we're not getting a benefit from that? The reality is we have all these different taxes. There are thousands of taxes that the government's come up with. It's not just our income tax. And if you do the math, the total American payroll, this is pre-COVID. I know this year kind of screwed things up, but the total American payroll is $8.5 trillion.
Wow.
$8.5 trillion. The government, the state, local, and federal governments collect $7.5 trillion from us every year, which is effectively a tax rate of 88% for everybody. And a lot of people say, oh, well, I'm lower income, so I don't pay that much income tax. That's not where most of the taxes come from. They come from vehicle registration fees. If you have a low income, that might account an annual registration fee of $100 might account for, you know, 1 or 2% more of your annual income, whereas somebody who's making $1 million, it's like 0.0001%.
Yeah.
All these little things add up. The gas tax, and this is where I'm going with this. The gas tax the way it was proposed was, okay, you have a car, you're going to use the roads. We have to pay to maintain these roads, so we'll tax the gas. So as you buy more gas, we use that money to pay for the roads. And that alone sounds like a fair system, right? You're only buying the gas to use the roads. So, you know, what's the problem, right? You're using the roads, you're paying for the roads. The problem is that through those gas taxes, they bring in something like $180 million a day, every day, just from the taxes. Wow. Most people don't even know that they're paying, because at the pump, it's not like this plus tax. It's like buried in the fine print. And most of that money never makes it to the roads. It's always diverted into like all these other programs. And this is fundamentally the problem that I have with taxes, is that would be great if, well, first of all, my big thing is consent, right? Like I have to like agree that, yes, I will pay you because I want something in return for that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when we're paying into a system that's just this giant slush fund, I mean, when I go and I get a job and I'm told, hey, we're going to pay you 10 bucks an hour or 15 bucks an hour, but you're only going to get 80% of that, and we're going to use the other 20% so we can drop bombs in the Middle East on some schools and weddings, then that's not a benefit to me.
No, it's not. I agree with that 100%.
And our only recourse is, you know, because if the system is, well, you have to pay your taxes because that's just the way things are. At what point do we get to say, I'm not going to pay this tax because I don't want to pay for these bombs without the fear of the government coming back and putting a gun in my face to say, no, you have to pay because that's just the way it is. And I think that's probably the most offensive part of this system.
Yeah, I do agree with that. You know, I'm so against all this bombing and invading countries and take, like, we spend so much money on the military industrial complex of our hard earned money. Like, literally, if you want to say it, all of us have blood on our hands because of the money that we've given to our government. And in turn, they've used it, and that money has gone towards wars. And it's really unfortunate. I do understand where you're coming from. Like, I do believe that we should have a say in where our money goes, and it should not just be a representative, because a lot of our representatives don't represent us.
Right.
Let's just be real.
They won't even pick up the phone if you call.
Absolutely not. And they make decisions without consulting their constituents. They don't even think about their constituents until it's time for elections. So, you know, I think we can agree on that one. I mean, I don't know. In that form, then yes, they're stealing our money and using it for things that we don't want to be done. But that's why we pull back from the military industrial complex. Let's take 55, 60%, 75% of the military budget, spending budget, and let's all have health care.
So, okay, you have kids, right?
Yes.
Okay. Have you ever given your kids money and said, okay, whatever you do, don't spend this on, you know, whatever, candy and something else. This is for, you know, go to the grocery store and buy something. Have you ever given them money and then they spent it on something they weren't supposed to?
No, because they're really little, but
okay.
I used to have students, so I would give money, like, or just, you know, reward my students. And I'd be like, listen, put it away, save that money. And they would come in with some sort of thing that I was like, you see, you just wasted your money, period. So yes, I've had that experience, not with my own children, but with my students.
Right. So I guess my point is, when it comes to government, like, okay, if you deposited your money into a bank and you found out that they were like not putting your money in the vault, they were like going out and partying with it, you'd probably go into the bank and say, hey, give me all my money back, and take it and put it somewhere else, right?
Yes.
With government, it's kind of like we're saying, okay, we're gonna give you the money. We're gonna pass some laws telling you how you can and can't spend it. But I think most of the country has been, I don't want to say most of the country, but a lot of the country has been anti-war since maybe like the, like Vietnam.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people have been very much against it. And yet still we've been consistently in other countries ever since. And it doesn't seem to matter what we want. And voting for different representatives never changes anything. Demanding that they stop going to war never changes anything.
Never. And
I think the only way to stop them is just to stop giving them money, because they're like the kid that, you know, they don't care what you want to do with your money. They just know it's my money now and I get to do whatever I want with it. And
yeah, the downside to that is you'll end up in jail.
Well, in this current world, yes. And it's although that's debatable too. If you follow the show long enough, I'm not paying taxes, and I know a lot of other people who are not paying taxes, and we know, you know, the whole Wesley Snipes story and everything like that. He was actually acquitted of all of his charges, but he had a corporation, which was his big mistake. But the way the law is written, and we can go back to rights, and if you want, I'm happy to explain it to you, but the way the law is written is it just doesn't even apply to most Americans. So the fact that we're paying income tax, unless we're working for the government, is actually the result of fraud. They have cheated us into thinking that we have to pay the income tax. Now, that's separate from all the other taxes that they have, and that only makes up for like a third of all the money they take. But that's another factor that's out there.
I mean, we can definitely have that conversation. I just don't ever see that conversation working for anyone that looks like me. I'm just going to be real. I live in a completely different America. Okay.
Sherry Peel Jackson. Go look her up after this.
Okay.
Although I will say she did do a little bit of jail time, but she was happy to do it. But she worked for the IRS, and she came to that same belief that we're not supposed to be paying income tax. So, but yeah, I totally agree with you. And that's actually, is it weird that I get into conversations with some of my friends with darker skin who believe that there is no systemic racism? Does systemic racism exist?
Yes, it absolutely does. And if they believe that it doesn't, I like to respect other people's opinions. I've just lived a different life. When you experience it, maybe they didn't experience it. And, you know, but you can't turn a blind eye to the hundreds, millions, thousands, whatever, of people that have experienced it, that experience it right now. This entire country is a system that was set up on racism. How can you say there's no systemic racism? Can we go back to slavery? Forget slavery. Let's go back to the indigenous people. Like, this is a system that has been set up against us. Martin Luther King did a speech called The Other America. There are two Americas. And yeah, I live in the other America.
I actually absolutely agree with you. And it's kind of frustrating to talk to somebody who, you know, tells me, how would I know, when, I mean, I grew up, a lot of my friends lived in Inglewood and South Central LA. A lot of them were Black and Hispanic. I've seen it. I've been pulled over in the middle of the night in, you know, for going, it was 3 o'clock in the morning in South Central LA. I got pulled over for going like 5 miles. I was being followed by a cop for like 5 blocks. I get, the speed limit changed. He pulled me over for going 5 miles over. We were like in our early 20s, maybe. I'm sure we all smelled like weed. And I had four people in the car. So four people plus me. And the cop was just like, you're in a dangerous neighborhood. You should go home. And I've been stopped other times where it's me and a Black friend. And like, my Black friend is getting a pat down. And they're just looking at me like, oh, you're okay. You're good to go. Like, I'm with him. We're having a conversation that you just interrupted. And so I've seen this stuff. And like, I can't look at that and say... And I think maybe one of the things that people object to is like, yeah, but that was just a racist cop. That wasn't systemic racism, but it's...
They were trained that way. They were trained to to behave that way. They were trained to seek you out and pat you down. They were trained to see you in a certain way. That is part of the system. So maybe they don't understand what systemic means.
Right. Well, and this is another thing too, because like, I think what they're looking for is they're looking for a case where, like, you know, there's a law that says, oh, if you're in possession of cocaine, if you're black, you get this many years. They're looking for something like that. And it's like, no, and here's the thing about, like, you know, we have laws that say you can't not hire someone for discriminatory reasons, right? And it's not like somebody's going to say, oh, we're not hiring this guy, he's black. It's no, we're not hiring this guy. And then they make up some reason when it's like, they're not going to put that on paper. And this is kind of the evil genius of the systemic racism is that they've been able to hide it.
Yeah.
In such a way. But so getting back to taxes, because I hate taxes, this is another problem that I look at and I'm like, I actually have a t-shirt that says taxes pay killer cops. We're forced to pay these people who, by the way, get to vote on their own raises. Oh, should we have a raise today? Yes, let's vote for ourselves for a raise. They vote for police. They vote to support police unions who vote to support police being protected whenever they kill an unarmed person of whatever race. This is another thing where it's like we're forced to pay for our own oppression. And I think that's like another thing that I look at and I'm like, how can people be happy paying taxes when they're taking that money and they're using it against us?
Yeah, exactly. When I look at these cop related murders, I'm just like, you know, the person you just killed actually contributed to your salary. Like, really? Like that's how you treat them? Wow. I was listening into the the meeting with the civil rights leaders and with Biden, now President Biden. And there was a woman from the NAACP, and she mentioned that in the Civil Rights Act, there is a section called Title VI that it is written into law that if any federal agency is caught using discriminatory practices, that their federal funding can be withheld from them. Law enforcement, federally funded. Don't tell me we can't prove that there's discrimination. Don't tell me that, because we have enough evidence. Why haven't we pulled the funding? There are a lot of laws that protect us, but we're not using that to our benefit too. I think that a lot of things get overlooked. Also, there's so many laws. it's sort of intense, but we've got to find the ones and start using those to our benefit. And if people are not going to stand up for us, then we need to actually take the law and say, listen, this is written. We do not have to pay for this anymore. And until you stop your discriminatory practice, you will not get funded.
Right. And I think the problem goes back to we still need to depend on the system to say, oh, we screwed up, we're not going to give them money. But I do want to bring this. I want to pitch this to you and see if I can plant the seed. Maybe you can take this, because I know there's a lot of people talking about defunding the police and abolishing the police. There was a plan when I ran for the Texas House in 2014. I came up with this thing called the Accountable Authority Act, which was, because this was one of the things that really got me started in politics was police misconduct. And one of the things that I put in there was I recognized that, kind of to this point that you just brought up, the police don't like to prosecute themselves, right? We conducted an investigation and found that there was no wrongdoing. Like, same exact words every single time.
Yeah.
And what kind of shocked me is that there's a process where, you know, if the police department shoots your dog, you can sue the police department and they can give you a little bit of money, right? You can file a civil lawsuit against them. But there's no way for a citizen to file criminal charges against a police officer. So in some cases, you have a cop who kills somebody. You in very rare cases, you might have, you know, they're able to scrape together enough money so they can sue the police department and they get a little bit of money back. Of course, you have a jury who's always concerned about, oh, we're going to give all this money to them. That's coming out of our taxes. So our taxes are going to go up. So I'm sure that's what they tell the juries to get them to vote against it. But in any case, if you do get that money, that's fine. But then the police department turns around and says, okay, well, we paid off that settlement. We settled out of court. Everybody go back to work. And you never have any criminal charge. When sometimes they are clearly criminal. Sometimes they're more accidental. And okay, maybe it was an accident. He shouldn't be a cop. Sometimes it's blatantly criminal. And this guy should be in jail. Where is the, and this is it, where is the idea, or where's the law that says we can also file a criminal lawsuit against a government officer, whether it's a police officer or whatever else, when the government won't do it because we already know they don't like to prosecute their own?
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I think that this can go on record. I'm totally gonna take that. Awesome. I'm just gonna take it off your hands. Don't worry. That is amazing. That would be great. I don't think I've heard anyone even make that case, because I mean, let's look at what happened with Jacob Blake. He was shot 7 times in the back and no charges against the officers whatsoever. And yeah, we just have to sit there and take it.
Absolutely.
Oh, we reviewed the tapes. Awesome. Like, yeah. So we didn't review the tapes. And nothing in that tape can justify shooting a man in his back 7 times in front of his children.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really disgusting how many times these people are shot in the back. And
yeah, let's talk like outside of here. I'd love to hear more about that.
Absolutely. Okay, so let me pitch you another one. All right. So a lot of people are saying defund the police. And I see a huge fundamental difference between police and sheriffs. Do you know, are you familiar with much of the difference?
More authority.
Okay. The sheriff is basically the elected executive of a county, of the law enforcement for a county. A police officer works for a city, which is an incorporated, it's basically a corporation. Yeah. In most cities, you get to vote for a mayor, but you don't get to vote for the chief of police.
The police chief, yeah. The but chief you, like, police, in our county, we voted for our sheriff.
Exactly. In every county, you vote for, or parishes in Louisiana, because they want to be different. but what's interesting is a sheriff. First of all, the sheriff himself is personally responsible for every single one of his deputies. So if one of his deputies commits a crime and he's like, yeah, I told him to do that, the sheriff himself is personally responsible in that. And he can be sued. He can be accountable to the people. He's in a more vulnerable position and he can be voted out. With a police chief, you can try to vote out the mayor and hope you get a better mayor who's going to fire the police chief. But that's not always the case. You can't vote him out. There is no accountability because he works for a corporation. The corporation can be sued. He cannot be sued. And it makes it creates a huge amount of protection for them and makes them far less accountable. So my proposition is to completely get rid of every police department and only use the sheriff as law enforcement in the entire country, because they should not have that extra protection. They should be vulnerable. We should be able to vote them out. We should have more control over them. They should be accountable to us and not to the mayor, who's basically the CEO of an incorporated city. What do you think about that?
That's not a bad idea either. I mean, it's not going to take away from the amount of officers or whatever. It may, but it just switches the authority. So now it's like, instead of it being the mayor that is in charge, having a mayor and a sheriff, you just have a sheriff. I mean, that's also something that I think would be a good proposition. I feel like everyone that's pushing defund the police, though, they want them all gone. I do think that we need some law enforcement, which then would be the sheriff and the deputies, the sheriff's office. That sounds very old school. I just feel like I'm in an old Western, and it's like the sheriff and the deputies.
There's a new sheriff in town.
Yeah, there's a new sheriff in town.
It is really interesting because, like, I remember kind of, so I grew up in LA, and so there was always like, I mean, there was LAPD, Inglewood PD, like Culver City PD. I was like in this area where there was like 10 different police departments if you go another block, but there was never really sheriff. And like, you didn't really hear about sheriff except for like in the old Western movies. But it's interesting. There's actually something like 600,000 sheriffs and deputies in the United States, and about that many police officers also. So it's really equal. But this is interesting because, like, I mean, do you live in a big city?
Yes, I live in a big city, and I also lived in LA for 7 years. So every time you say an LA city, I'm like, oh, Inglewood, I went to church. Culver City, I went to acting class. Like, I just think of all the places that I enjoy.
Oh, awesome. We'll have to talk more about that later, too.
Yeah.
So growing up in LA, like, I even pictured the entire state of California was just like LA. Like, I took my first road trip when I was like 18 or something, and I was like, we have farms in California? cows, what? And it's really interesting because, you know, going back to this idea of incorporated cities, once you go outside of an incorporated city, you're in what they call an unincorporated area, and there is no police. There's only sheriffs. This goes back to the self-defense thing, and, you know, people who are, I know you're not completely anti-gun, but people who are very anti-gun, who say we should completely ban everything. Like, I feel like they've never stepped outside of the city into those areas, because those are the places where, like, you call 911 and, like, the sheriff might show up 2 hours later because he has to drive halfway across the county.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's a busy night. There was one other thing going on.
Yeah.
so yeah, it's pretty wild. But, okay, cool. So, let's see. We're coming up on about 52 minutes into the show. Do you have a little bit more time to talk about housing?
I do have a little more time.
Okay, awesome. So, housing. Let me just start here. What's your proposed let me ask this first. What is the problem and what is the solution?
The problem, we have a bunch of greedy landlords that want all of this money and raise the rent. Like I said, I born and raised in Miami, but I lived in LA, both very expensive places to live. Growing up in Miami, there were about 10 of us living in the house at the same time. And that was because we had three different families that couldn't afford a home on their own. So we all just sort of made it work, sleeping on the couch, sleeping on the floor, not kidding. Like, we all slept everywhere. And then going to LA, thinking that, oh my gosh, it's gonna be awesome. I'm gonna be a starving artist. Now, I wasn't just starving. I also didn't have a place to stay. I remember the first night I slept in my car, I was crashing at my friend's couch. She had fallen asleep. I had just gotten off work. They asked me to work a double at the restaurant. I didn't get to charge my phone. My phone died. My friend was asleep. I slept in my car. My thing is just like, how is it that we pay so much in taxes, that we live in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, that we do so much for America, and yet America is okay with letting us just sleep on the street or sleep in our cars or pay exorbitant amounts for rent? I mean, right now I met a family on Sunday and they said, Christine, can you help us find somewhere else to live? We're paying $2,100 and one of the family members has stage 4 cancer. Everything's very expensive. They need another place, but $2,100 a month. Like, who has that right now in the middle of COVID? Anyway, so my take on this is landlords should not be able to, there should be rent control. I remember I was living, I finally was able to live somewhere in LA with my friend. She was paying $650 a month because her place was rent controlled. She was older. She was like a 60-year-old Mexican lady. That's a story for another day, but we were like Bonnie and Clyde. Anyway, and she had this place forever, right? We were totally just an odd couple, like little young 20-year-old black girl and the 60-year-old Mexican lady. And we just did everything together. And she let me crash and then eventually live. I was paying, what, $325 a month to split it. And then when she passed, they raised the rent. They were waiting for her to pass because they couldn't break that lease. They were waiting for her to pass. Do you know how much the rent is now for that one bedroom? Right now it's about like $1,850, $1,900 for a one bedroom. And that's on like, and the nice, that's on a low end.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely grew up around there. I remember my first apartment, actually, I moved to the Valley because that was like the only
place you can get anything affordable
and split it with like five people.
Yeah,
because it is nuts. But so, okay, so the solution is somehow to force the rents down so that it's more affordable. So what is the solution? Well, okay, let me propose this first. When I was living in LA, when I was probably in my early 20s, I was sick of being broke, and I ran into some people that turned me into a seminar junkie, and I was like, okay, let's do this, let's get rich. And one of the things that they would pitch is buying rental properties and using them to rent, and then you get the rental income.
Yeah.
And no matter how I looked at that, first of all, I couldn't even afford a down payment in LA because it's ridiculous. And I was, you know, I was still my early 20s. I didn't have any money to speak of and terrible credit. But I would still do the math and say, okay, if I wanted to buy a house so that I could rent it, I would not be able to, and I would do the math between the cost of the monthly payments, including the property tax, the rent, the property tax, the insurance, and the loan itself, and then how much I would be able to rent it for fair market value based on, you know, what something else in the neighborhood was doing. And the only way I could figure out to make it work, I would make something like $10 a month. So, and I know a lot of landlords are in that position. They're making payments on the house that they're renting to somebody. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the pressures on them to raise that rent.
And especially when the
government keeps coming around saying, hey, we're going to raise the property tax because in California, this is how they do it. Oh, everybody's leaving California, which means fewer people are paying taxes. We're going to raise the property tax so that we can bring in more money. And this all forces the rents up. So, knowing, I guess the main point I wanted to point out was that knowing what the market for the rent is and knowing what the cost for buying, for having the loan on a property, and knowing that there's not much profit in that to begin with, how do you propose getting the rent down and not just forcing a landlord to contribute? Because obviously, you know, if I look at this and I'm like, okay, well, by the time I get the rent money and then pay my mortgage, I'm actually going to be losing money every month. So I'm going to have to get a job to support a house or an apartment that somebody else is living in. How do you force that down without creating that type of environment?
I mean, it's a difficult question. That's not something that I'm going to be able to just spit out an answer, only because we're going to have to think about this. We're going to have to sit down, because I understand I'm an entrepreneur myself. So I totally get, from the business standpoint, you want to make a profit, right? You don't want to just, you didn't buy these apartments just for them to sit there and for you to make what, a dollar or two off of each one. But I think that housing is, how do I explain this? It's not just, we don't just have a housing issue. We also have a wage issue. We have an unemployment issue, or we have, I don't know how you feel about universal basic income. We have a universal basic income issue. Like there's so many different things that go into how we can then afford housing in America, on top of figuring out a way so that the landlords don't end up losing out as well. So I think that is something. There needs to be a commission on housing. There needs to be, and I mean, obviously we have HUD, but we're not just talking about government housing. We need programs also for people that just, you know, private lenders or private owners. We need programs for everyone. And this is a conversation that we all need to come to terms with. Like, there are people living in tents. They can't even if you lowered the rent, they couldn't afford it. So now we have an unemployment issue. Or do we talk about a universal basic income? So you can't talk about a housing problem without talking about, you know, the three or four other problems that are attached to it.
Right. So what I'm hearing is, I mean, okay, and no offense, but I hear you bring up a lot of Democrat talking points that are, in my opinion, boil down to throw some government money at it and it'll make it go away, right? Like the UBI and that sort of thing. And let me take a step back first and say I completely agree with you. The wealthiest nation in the world should not have so many people living in their cars, living on the street, and all this other stuff. I want to make another pitch here. If you like it and if you decide to adopt it, don't tell the Democrats because they'll probably kick you out. But this is okay. So first I boil down the problem to the very basics, right? We have a problem where there's money in, money out, right? Your wages and your cost of living. And the problem is that the wages are smaller than the cost of living. The cost of living is really high. The wages are really low. So if we can bring the wages up and bring the cost of living down, everyone's going to be a little bit happier.
Yes.
Okay. So what I would propose for that is a few different things. And there's four things that I usually point out. The first one is property tax. If you were to completely eliminate that, if you talk about, okay, when I was talking about being a landlord, property tax was one of the things I had to factor into the absolute lowest I could make the rent and still be able to make some money. If you eliminate the property tax, I guarantee you, if it makes up 20% of the rent, everybody's rent is going to go down by 20%. And a lot of people say, well, do you think the landlords are just going to lower their prices? Because, like, why wouldn't they just keep the extra 20% for themselves? Well, it works the opposite way, too.
Our cities and our states make money off of the property taxes. That's how they function. That's how they pay for sewage.
But like we said, most of that money gets wasted, right? It's just another tax on top of the thousands of other taxes that are getting wasted. So, and especially in places where most of the places I've lived, I didn't pay a tax for the sewage. When I got my water bill, it was included in that.
Yes, but what I'm saying is like for the projects to like right now I have a septic tank. You know, my taxes are going so that eventually one day we can all, because I can't stand this septic tank. So, you know, eventually they're going to do a big project where we're going to be converted into the main, you know, the main line. And there's a lot of beautification projects and grants that we give to small businesses. All of these things come from everybody paying their property taxes. I know that you say it gets wasted, but I've seen the budgets. They include the cities include us in the meetings. You get to go and you get to see where they're going to spend the money and vote on what you want. So I have seen that not all the money gets wasted. At least here, I live in Hollywood, Florida. Here I have actually seen the difference.
Is it possible that just like how we talked about systemized racism being hidden, is it possible that the waste is being hidden through the cost of things? For example, they always make fun of
course.
the $30,000 hammer and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I of course they're like, you know, moving some money around, just hiding it with masking it with this. We're going to be planting trees all throughout Hollywood, you know,
right, and then they're paying like $100,000,
but it really costs like maybe half of that. Yes. I'm right. Sure. There's, of course, you know, I mean, I don't have evidence of that. Nobody accused me of accusing anyone.
Okay.
Sure.
So let me go after my second point, which is the FHA. So, and this comes from living down here in Mexico and seeing how people buy homes down here. And we're talking about people who are generally very poor compared to American standards, but everybody seems to own a house or own property down here. And I've looked into this, and the reason is, in the United States, we have a program called the FHA, which when you buy a home, they have like an insurance program and everything else so that a bank will lend you the money to buy a house with only 3% down.
Yeah.
And it's a 30-year loan. In Mexico, they don't have that program. And so for a bank to take on the risk of lending you money to buy a house, they're not going to give you more than like 50%. So you have to make 50% down. But here's the thing. When you go into a bank, they're not really concerned about the size of the loan, right? They're more concerned about how much can you afford, right? They're not concerned about what does the house cost. They're concerned with, let's give you the biggest loan you can possibly get because we want to make the most profit in interest. Mm-hmm. So if you go into a bank and they say, okay, you can afford $1,000 a month. Well, how much money are they going to lend you for a house if you're going to get a 5-year loan at 50% down? So you're going to be paying for 5 years, $1,000 a month, or we're going to give you this amazing 30-year long loan for $1,000 a month. And because the government is going to insure it, we're going to let you do only 3% down. What this does is, just like 2008 housing bubble, these banks are able to lend so much more money to somebody who really can't afford that house. They're making it work. And what this ends up doing is, this person is now going back to the house that they wanted. And let's say the market before FHA was $100,000 for this house. This person is now looking at this house. Oh, somebody already put in a bid for $100,000. Well, the bank gave me $200,000, so I want to bid $200,000 on it. And they start getting very short-sighted. And I know this because they tried to sell me an interest-only loan in 2008. But what's interesting is, if you look at the history of the FHA and before the FHA, people were paying 50% down on their house. They were getting loans that were only 5 or 10 years long, which, and this is another thing, the average American gets their first house when they're 32 years old, which means they're just barely done paying it off when they're almost 65 and ready to retire. So they're spending all their money over the course of their life when they could.
Yeah, you pay three times over for your house.
Exactly.
I know, we own.
But not just the three times over from the interest, but the three times over from the inflated price from all that money going in. So what I would propose as another measure is to eliminate the FHA, to bring the price of the housing down, to make it so that people can pay off their houses in 5 years, so that, you know, hopefully the next coronavirus doesn't come around ever. But if it comes around in another 5 years, everybody who buys their house today, at least they're going to be paid off and they're not worried about rent and everything else when, you know, businesses are shutting down and everything else. What do you think about eliminating the FHA for that reason?
Good luck. That is that, like, I listen, that sounds great. I can pay my house off in 5 years. That would be awesome. We've had this house for 7 years. It would be paid off. I could be living my life, living the dream. That, you know how much money America makes off of the housing industry? Off of people buying homes, first time homeowners that go in and want the best house ever. And no, that's not happening. I think that that's really great. I'm all about dreaming.
So, yeah. Well, okay.
America's too greedy for that plan. Too greedy.
I completely agree with you, but don't you think that America's too greedy to, in the same way, pay for a UBI? I mean, aren't we kind of like, isn't it the same powers that would resist
No, because so I think that America pays, or the government pays, for a lot of different programs, and I think that a UBI would eliminate some of those programs. So it would almost be like shifting the resources. They're already paying for a lot of this anyway, like the WIC programs, or the, you know, just welfare programs in Section 8. They're already paying for all of these different programs. So it would be really shifting that and putting money directly in people's hands and saying, listen, you know, we want you to get on the right track. We want you to have your basic necessities. Here, take this, do what you have to do. But then, you know, obviously phase out some of these other programs.
Right. But at the same time, and this is a fun fact that my friends like to point out, is that corporate welfare is something like 10 or 20 times individual welfare. So when you talk about, like, you know, WIC and all these other programs, those are so small compared to what these big corporations are getting. So if you talk about shifting money around, I mean, if you talk about a UBI program, that's going to cost, I think Andrew Yang's was supposed to cost like $3 trillion a year, which is more than half of the entire federal annual budget. But, and so if you were to shift that money around, either you would have to double what they're taking in taxes, which you've got the greedy corporations.
We need to tax the 1% their fair share. They need to pay, because they're not.
Right, but at the same time, those are the guys who are all connected with Congress, who are making sure that they have their tax loopholes and everything else. And I think, you know, it's you're absolutely right to say good luck, because yes, for that plan to pass, to get rid of the FHA, there would be a lot of resistance from a lot of major corporations, everybody in the mortgage industry, the banks. The Federal Reserve doesn't want to do that because that's where they're making all their profit. The IMF probably. And you're absolutely right. But I think at the same time, those are the same powers that would push back against a UBI, unless there was something in it for them with the UBI, such as, you know, creating some sort of dependence, which, you know, a lot of those guys like too. But I think if we had to choose between those, I would say it would be easier to get rid of the FHA, because at the same time, it comes back to the two options of giving them all the money and hoping that they're going to do the right thing with it, versus withholding the money, withholding the power, keeping the power in our own hands, so that we don't have to hand it over to people who are known to be corrupt. I think if we went in, and you're absolutely right, it's a hard sale. But I think ultimately we would progress much quicker as a society. We'd get to be more like Mexico, where 80% of the country owns a home, owns property, and they never have to worry. This is the other beautiful thing about getting rid of property tax. You never have to worry about being dragged out of your house by the government because you couldn't pay your taxes. I mean, we talk about rent is terrible. Imagine you've already paid off your house. Now you're retiring. Your Social Security barely pays for your property tax. Yeah. And you have to decide, okay, am I going to pay my property tax or buy my food? And then especially when Congress is like threatening, oh, if we don't do such and such, we're not going to be sending out Social Security checks this month. Then you get into a fight with the state government, who's going to say, well, you didn't pay your property tax, you're 2 months behind, and therefore we get to take your entire house from you. Which is, I would say, one of, I don't know why I didn't bring that up first, that's probably one of the worst parts about the property tax.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You never really own anything in America. Somebody can always take it from you. It's never officially yours.
But should that be the case, or should we?
No,
should
absolutely not. Like I said, America's greedy, but that's why we have people running like us that actually care about people. Like we said, I think we spoke about this privately. I don't know if it was on this, but we can start from a place of we care for people. Like that's our common ground. How we go about doing that will be different. It'll look different in policy, but we care about people. We need people that care about people to start running and start filling in these seats that are being occupied by greedy, power hungry, insane, crazy politicians that only care about themselves, have no logic behind half of the policies that they push, and still get elected time and time again.
Absolutely. All right. So I know I've already held you over the normal length of the show, but I absolutely want to thank you for this. And I definitely, for anybody listening, especially when like everybody is really torn into this like really polarized fight of, oh, you don't support my party, you can go to hell. I like one of the things I really like to do is have these conversations because we have different ideas. We're exchanging. We're learning from each other. We're getting to stand in each other's shoes and see things from different perspectives, learn things we didn't know before. I think this is really amazing. And as I like to say, always go into a conversation with somebody who disagrees with you with an open mind that everything that you know is wrong, because you might learn something. But if you close your ears and think you know everything, you're never going to learn anything. So yeah. I think this has been an awesome conversation. I want to thank you for reaching across party lines and having this conversation. I want to thank you for liking a couple of my pitches. Definitely take those and run with them. Awesome. I want to give you an opportunity because I know you're running for the Florida House in 2022. I want to give you the floor to give us your pitch. If anybody's interested, if they're in your area, if they want to support you, where can they go? That sort of thing.
Well, before I do that, I want to thank you personally for reaching out, for even bringing me on the show. This was a pleasant conversation. I came into this not thinking that we were about to go to war, but just thinking that we were going to take some time to understand each other. And I feel like I got that. So really, thank you so much. And thank you for having this platform where you do allow a difference of opinions and nobody ends up dying in the end. So for those of you that don't know me, my name is Christine Olivo. You can go to christineforcongress.org. Right now, the site's under construction because we have put a new platform together for this 2022 run. But in just a little while, in like about a week or so, you'll be able to see everything that I'm fighting for. I'm fighting to end the wars. I'm fighting for climate change. I'm fighting for Medicare for all. I'm fighting for racial justice because it's time for us to have racial justice. I'm fighting so that we can all live and not feel that we are being oppressed or not feel like we're living in another America, but that we all share the same America, one that is equal, free, and true for all of us. Thank you so much for having me on. If you live in Florida or if you know anyone that lives in Florida, I would love to convince them to vote for me. So, hit me up. either way, I just want everyone to know that I respect your opinions. We respect each other's opinions. Let's move forward into this next season of our country's history unified under one purpose, knowing that we are just fighting for the betterment of all Americans.
Awesome. Christine, thank you so much for joining me tonight. This really has been an awesome conversation, and I hope to have more like it. I hope anyone listening can learn from this, and use this as an example of a polite conversation that you can have with somebody you don't disagree with, because that seems to be missing from our society these days. So absolutely. If you liked what you heard in this episode, please make sure to share it. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, and of course, if you want to get the podcast, this is available as a podcast wherever your favorite podcasts are found. Whatever app you use, you'll find us. Just look for Taxation is Theft. And of course, if you want to support the show, head over to taxationistheft.info and support us just by getting some of our really cool swag. We've got awesome stuff from hats to license plates and flags and t-shirts and all kinds of crazy stuff. So check it out, and I'll see you guys next time. Taxation is Theft.